Welcome to Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goler. In discomforting times filled with malicious actors, it can be easy to feel the world is shockingly indecent. Sacred Legions believes we need to focus on people our patron saint, author Kurt Vonnegut, identified as secular saints, people behaving decently in these seemingly indecent times. While bad actors oftentimes have the megaphone, we want to remind you that every day secular saints like yourselves have the numbers. Today, I have the privilege of welcoming Hugh Megby, who is our secular saint of human rights. Welcome to the program, Hugh.
Oh, thank you so much, Max. Glad to be here.
So I had a chance to talk to you and just get to know you a little bit the other day, and I was so fascinated by so much of what you shared. I found it fascinating, too, that you've got a pretty strong association with the Quakers. And one of the guests that we had before, who had hosted some of Martin Luther King Jr.'s family members in their household, were also Quakers. So I found that a fascinating connection. Can you tell me about your background?
Yes, I was born and raised in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And for those of you who don't know, Cambridge was very much like Boston. It had tracking. It was essentially a racial segregation tool to essentially keep black males out of college. We were tracked into the vocational schools. My parents both had master's degrees, so it was genetically possible for me to be accepted to college. But in the eighth grade, our teachers made sure that we weren't going to go. I did get into the good high school, and I really failed terribly because it was all set up against us. So my parents very nicely sent me to a Quaker boarding school in New Hampshire called the Meeting School, and I spent my high school years there. It was an intentional community. It was a farm. If we didn't grow it, we couldn't eat it. And all decisions were made by consensus. But more importantly, it infused me with a sense of justice, peace, and an ability to look, as the Quakers say, to see God in every man. I can tell you that the Quaker education was probably the most important educational experience of my life. It did truly change me in many ways. During the time I was affiliated with the school, I became involved with the American Friends Service Committee in Cambridge. And at that time, we were marching to ban the bomb. This was in the late 50s. And you can see a movie of me. It was taken in 1959, I believe, or 1960, where my school and myself were ringing the Pentagon in a silent witness for peace. And I was 15 years old at the time. But prior to my experience at the Meeting School, I grew up in a very political family. Both of my parents were very active in the Democratic Party in Massachusetts. My father was working very much with a couple of governors and was very political. My mother as well. They are founding members of the Cambridge Civic Association, which is now the machine in Cambridge, Progressive Reform Party, that came up in the early 50s in Cambridge, that is now still a very important part of Cambridge politics. I met Malcolm. I met Martin, and that dichotomy of those two people probably describes me better than anyone else. I am a walking, talking contradiction. I have been infused with Quaker values, values of nonviolence, but I'm also a child of the 60s and of Black Panther movement, the Black Liberation Movement, and radical Black politics. Most of them, I'm sure, would tell you that freedom doesn't come unless it comes from the barrel of a gun. And many of us waved the little red book around in demonstrations and talked about revolution as if we knew what we were talking about. But revolution is a very messy, nasty business.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, too, because I remember when I was younger, that kind of youthful exuberance towards what needed to be done. And you're right. You look at history. And historically, change did tend to happen violently, and it does go against the teachings that you have through being a Quaker and, quite honestly, through being a decent human being a lot of times.
Indeed. And I think I can point to many, many instances where nonviolent resistance has been effective, certainly in India with Gandhi, mm-hmm. I think in South Africa as well, and other countries that have had some form of liberation. So whether it be in South America, in Africa, or even in Europe, or in the Far East. But those fights against fascism, not necessarily against an oligarchy or something else, but a fight against real fascist, seems to take a violent solution to be able to eradicate an infestation of fascists. I was just looking at something online which affected me pretty deeply this morning. A white woman got up and she started talking about the alienation that Black people are feeling now, that they feel as if they've been abandoned both by the Democratic Party and the country itself. We've been here, my family's been here since 1766. My wife's family, that's on my father's side. Okay. On my mother's side, we are Native Americans. On my father's side, we were slaves. I married a descendant of the Mayfly. We are Thanksgiving in our family.
Right.
And that contradiction is really what it's all about. I reflected on what this woman had to say this morning about how the Black folks are alienated from what's going on right now. They don't seem to want to step up. They don't want to seem to demonstrate. They don't want to seem to want to do any of those things. They seem to have opted out. And I identify with that very strongly. I feel very much betrayed by white America. I feel very betrayed by my country. I feel very betrayed by the Democratic Party, whose inability to be effective or to have any sort of response to what we're looking at is very, very depressing. And I think most Americans feel that themselves. But Black folks and minorities in particular, who are the targets of ICE and the targets of anti-DEI and all of these other machinations which want to rationalize racism, we are appalled. We are coming off 8 years of a Black presidency, which was incredibly successful. And we now are in this because folks are feeling bad and feeling small, that they are not as revered as our former president and those who supported him. I saw this when we ran Hillary Clinton. One of the things in my background is that I've worked for the Democratic Party as a volunteer for 13 or 14 years in the state of Maine. I was a county chair for the Democratic Party and part of the state committee. So I got to see the inner workings of the party and got to see how it works and where it works and who we go after and who we don't. Maine being one of the whitest states in the union, I didn't expect that would be a lot of support for Black folks in the state of Maine, but I was appalled in the fact that they didn't want any Black folks involved in the Democratic Party in the state of Maine. And they did everything they could to discourage us. When Obama ran, a whole bunch of Black folks came to the convention. It was the first and last time we ever saw him.
Wow.
No one made any effort to recruit or get those people, and yet they overwhelmed the convention at that time. So I am under no illusions as to where the Democratic Party is. And they, white liberals, I think, feel almost as alienated as MAGA does in the fact that things are changing in America. By 2047, minorities will be the majority in this country. And let me tell you, that's exactly what MAGA's freaking out about.
Which to me is crazy, because in the end, it's all about the humanity. There's no lack of humanity in any group. Like, my daughter is living in the Twin Cities right now. And of course, there's this huge influx of targeting immigrant populations, but they're all human beings. There is no illegal person in this country, especially if you're going to reflect on the fact that this country was established illegally by stealing land from indigenous populations.
I just had a meeting with my cousin who informed me that we are direct descendants of a gentleman called Meta Comet, who in Massachusetts is known as King Philip. And King Philip was a Wampanoag chief who had been to Britain, educated in Oxford in the 1600s, and came back and told the native folks, you better watch out. These folks intend to take it all. And he started a war that almost drove all the colonists into the sea. That's a pretty important person to have in your background, okay? I'd mentioned that I marched with Martin. I also knew Malcolm. and Stokely and H. Rapp were friends. My cousin is real big in the Panthers. All of these people have made an influence on me that when I come to today's political situation, I am conflicted. I have a sense of dissonance here. I reflect on my Quakerism and I reflect on the beauty and the truth that is spoken among Quakers. They do get it. But then I recognize that the atrocities that are being visited upon people in this country and because of this country in Gaza,
yes,
in Africa, and other places, in the name of this country, this has gone on and devolved to a point that I don't know if I can recognize or even understand how we could possibly come up with a nonviolent solution to this problem.
I would like to talk to you too. When we chatted the other day, you shared a lot about your background, which to me was fascinating because you have lived both in the United States and outside of the United States, and you've worked more diverse jobs than a lot of people that I know. And yeah, I would really love to be able to reflect on that just to show how incredibly important you are and how accomplished you are.
Thank you so much for saying that. But, you know, the title of your program, Secular Saints, sometimes I really don't feel like a saint, Max.
No, we get that all the time. I promise like you.
I feel like I need to atone for my sins sometimes.
We get that from just about every guest. It is kind of, and I mean, as the host of the show, I certainly have many, many failings that would keep me from ever identifying as a saint. But it's that voice of decency in these indecent times, and it's the work that you're doing towards creating a decent society that, you know, in a time when it isn't particularly decent. So in that way, you are definitely a saint.
I think I've done my share of contributing to a betterment of the country. And in one way, maybe another way you haven't maybe even known about, you're alluding to the fact that I've had a corporate life experience. Mm-hmm. I have worked in high tech and biotech for 30 years as a technical recruiter or as a medical recruiter, hiring people for biotech companies, pharmaceutical companies, and high tech companies, computer companies. Much of my time there was spent in recruiting minorities for these companies. And in doing so, I increase the wealth of the community. We have Black engineers now. We have Black scientists. We have Black pharmaceutical medicinal chemists. We have all sorts of Black software and hardware engineers and computers. And all of that is due to a concerted effort by companies and people like myself to make sure that these companies included other people. Why would we do such a thing? In these days, I sometimes wonder myself. But most of the companies I worked for understood very much that their economic futures were tied to the widest possible audience they could get.
Yes.
The more people who were on board with company X, Y, or Z, the better it was for them. And if they came from different backgrounds and different places, so much the better for the company. The company grew better because of that.
Yeah, it's interesting that capitalism works off of that model of get the biggest audience, the biggest buying population that we can get. But they don't tend to follow that up with treating everyone equally and equitably. Yeah.
Well, I have one word for you, Max. Target. Good old Target tried that. They're not doing so well right now. They're not doing so well at all. And I think that is a very much of an object lesson as to the buying power of minorities, the buying power of allies, the buying power of awake, woke folks who get it. Target, they get it. They're getting it. If they don't get it now, they're getting it.
Well, I'm glad that you bring that up too, because we're trying to promote volunteerism and self-care on the website from Sacred Legions. And you're right that one of the things that people can do that requires very little effort is if you identify someone who is giving loads of money to a country or whatever that's killing its citizens, we have that power in just boycotting business to eliminate some of that, right?
Yeah. And that's if I want to remain positive and on the good foot.
Right.
Okay. When I'm on the bad foot, I see things very differently. And I wrote a piece this morning based on my own depression about the fact that how alienated we now feel from the country. And if they instituted segregation, I think we'd be jumping for joy. That we don't have to get involved with the all anymore. That's the part that I don't really know how to deal with. I'm a human being.
Yes.
I feel these things. And what I'm feeling is you've asked for us to sort of point you in the direction of company or other institutions and organizations that make a difference. And some of the folks you've had on, who I know, have made a big difference. My life is a little different. I sort of tip over garbage cans in the middle of the night. I bang on rooftops sometimes in the middle of the night. And sometimes even I must appear as a crazy person to some, because I've unfortunately, thanks to the Quakers, been blessed with something they call clearness, which is an ability to cut through the bullshit, take a look at the kernel, the meat of the problem, the nut of the problem. What's really going on here, guys? There's so much chatter and so much misinformation, wrong information, misdirection, lies, propaganda, all of these things. And it's not just the media, it's everybody is consumed by this. The inability to be clear, I think, is part of our problem. And that's an educational process. Anything else, I think, I'd send all my money to the Quakers if I was having to do something like that, if I believed that the Quakers could solve this problem. As much as I love them and as much as I honor them and believe in what they say is true, and I believe in nonviolent resistance, I say you should put a stick in the spokes of fascism. At one time, and I think we've seen this in the Twin Cities just this week, what is the tipping point? What is the tipping point from nonviolent demonstrations, resistance, and murder on the streets?
Yeah.
What's the tipping point? I think we're very quickly getting to that tipping point. And we are reaching out for allies. We're scared. We're scared as people. We're scared as a country. We're scared to death. My children are totally freaked out. They have young families.
Mm-hmm.
Wanting, Dad, where should we go? Where should we go, Dad? Those are horrifying questions. I was lucky when I grew up to grow up with people who had been in the Holocaust, people with tattoos on their wrist. And when those folks, when we were young and we asked them about the tattoos, they told us about the tattoos and what they meant. I have friends who left Germany at the very last moment and were so lucky to get out. Everybody else in their family died. Are we at that point now?
It's interesting that you mentioned that. I taught English for a long time, and one of the things in Indiana that I did as a result of that was I did a Holocaust unit every year. We were required to teach our students about the Holocaust in the state of Indiana. And so my approach to it was not just to look at the Holocaust, but to look at the subject of man's inhumanity to man as a whole. So that took in the United States' treatment of indigenous populations. It took in South Africa's treatment of populations down there and in Gaza and Israel, all of those places where that inhumanity has existed. And I think it is important that we constantly look at what produced those situations.
I think I told you about this woman that I saw this morning, made an impression on me. And one of the things that she was talking about is how the struggle has come to people who never expected that the struggle would be part of their lives. I have been very fortunate to have a summer home in Canada, in Cape Breton Island, where the beauty of the island is only exceeded by the beauty of the hearts of the people. And in Canada, to see the revulsion that they have now against Americans, not all Americans, but MAGA Americans in particular, and their own country is being torn apart by MAGA. Right now, there's a referendum going on in Alberta to secede from the country of Canada. And it's got maybe a third of Albertans ready to do that. I am worried. I am worried for Canada. I'm worried for Mexico. I'm very worried for Mexico. He claims he wants to invade Mexico to get rid of the cartels, just like he supposedly has done in Venezuela. You do realize he hasn't made a dent in squat in Venezuela, and he's stealing oil. That oil is being stolen. It's being stolen from ships that he sees in the middle of the road, and he climbs on them and steals the ships, and then he says, that's Venezuelan oil. I'm taking it. Wow. Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes, no doubt.
Okay, we got all this crap going on. What are we gonna do about it? You've got people on your radio program all the time talking about awful stuff.
Yes.
What are we gonna do about it?
I do. And it can be kind of overwhelming at times. You're like, I don't want to live in a world like this. But I will say, and I brought this up at the beginning of the show, you've got a lot of people that have megaphones that are very, very loud and very, very bad. But the numbers are definitely on the side of decent people.
Yes.
It's just how do you mobilize those decent people when the game has been rigged against us and we're divided over ridiculous things so that we don't get the numbers that we need to be able to push back against the insanity.
I'm a generation of people who stopped a war, the Vietnamese War. We stopped it. We also got rid of Tricky Dick. Okay? We have experience in doing these things. We actually know how to do these things. Unfortunately, the game that we played back in 1970, 1968, and everything has changed.
Yes.
It has and it hasn't. I looked at a movie about Nuremberg, and they talked about the corruption of the judicial system being the last check and balance. If the Congress has gone crooked and the president's gone crooked, you've got the judicial system, right? That'll hold everybody in line. And as we've seen, that is not the case. So if the jig is up, what are we going to do?
It does require a lot of thought and patience to figure out what to do. And I think we're all kind of wondering what that will be. I will say that I appreciate people doing everything they can. I have been involved in and seen so many peaceful protests voicing their opposition. And I think the numbers are reflecting in polls and everything else. And I think that people are running scared because of that. But now we just need to actually get some positive out of all this.
Well, I wish I had your outlook. I wish I did, Max. Oh, yo, I would be so wonderful. But as a Black person in America, I would be saying that I was taking the greatest drug in the world if I believed that nonviolence, standing on a street corner, thousands, millions of us, is going to change anything with these people.
So let me do this, because again, I talked to you the other day and I was just so impressed by the life that you've led. And it kind of reminded me of myself that there's a lot of good things that have happened in your life. There have been a lot of challenges that you faced in your life. But from what I heard, I think that you would mostly characterize your life as having been pretty successful for you and your family, I hope.
For the most part, I think as we get older, things become more challenging due to health and economic issues. But for the most part, I would say my life has been idyllic. And living in this country and living outside of the country in the Caribbean has given me a very rich life, one that is filled with culture and politics and people and family and all of those different things. And you reflect on so many people in the United States. I think you had Pat LaMarsh on your program, and Pat is a real saint because she's been dealing with homeless people.
Right.
Homelessness. I can't imagine that. But as I get older, I could even see myself being homeless eventually.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've worked with Pat a lot on a lot of that stuff. And you're right. It takes nothing, especially in these environmental degraded times. It takes nothing for someone to suddenly become homeless. We had one person on this podcast earlier who lived in Paradise, California, when it went up in flames.
In flames.
And all those people were suddenly homeless. And yeah, there were a privileged few that were able to get back on their feet, but that was still a devastating event.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. I lived 10 years in the Caribbean.
Okay.
On St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And in 2015, we got hit by two Category 5 storms in 1 week. Okay? 90% of the housing was gone. Today, everybody's living in a house. There's very little homelessness on St. Croix or in the Virgin Islands. Everybody banded together to make it happen for everybody. We didn't have any power. We didn't have any water. We didn't have a lot of things. But nobody died in the hurricanes.
And I love the fact that you said the people down there banded together to make sure that everybody was taken care of. And that's what I think we need, is those people that are looking out for their communities one-on-one.
It takes a mind change. It takes a huge mind change. It was interesting during the hurricane. So the islands are a hodgepodge of lots of different people from all over the world. 90% of the people are people of color and 10% are white. And yet 10% of the residents have the best houses and the best jobs and all of those different things. So that creates an income inequality and an anger, which I think is palpable and created a murder rate on St. Croix higher than Detroit in the 70s. Racial killings, all kinds of different kind of killings were occurring. We don't see that now. And the reason we don't see that is because of the hurricanes. The hurricanes were the great levelers. Billionaires lost their homes right along with people making $50,000 a year. Everybody lost their home. Everybody lost everything that was in their home.
That's an incredible perspective that I don't think I've heard on the podcast before. And you're right. It's interesting. You talk about, you've seen different times in the Virgin Islands in the 70s. This is the way it was. Then you get these hurricanes. Everybody suddenly equalized and everybody comes together and is able to behave decently with each other, which I think is a great example of why that diversity of income can be a big problem.
Well, in the Virgin Islands, we call it Virgin Islands Strong. That's what we call it. And we now have seen an opportunity for everybody, especially the white community, not to gentrify, but to assimilate. And that's part of the problem I think we have in the United States. We have people who are on the track, the upward track. I was on that track. I was on that upward track. I own 3 houses, Mercedes-Benz, S-Class. Wow. Everything anybody could want. Kids in private school, all of those different things. And they blind you to the plight of the other. When you are on your trail with your Audi, then you better hope they can get theirs because you got yours. Our ability to get our personal self-esteem through what we own and what we got is part of the problem.
Yeah, it's not a good measuring stick. It reminds me when I talked to Mike Draper on this podcast, and he was saying that he had heard a conversation that Kurt Vonnegut was involved in where they were kind of being envious of the rich class that they were with or whatever. In their discussion, they came to the conclusion of, yeah, they have all of these things, but They also don't know when they've had enough. And that's where we have the distinct advantage over them. We know when we've got enough, and we know that we're happy with enough.
Boy, you hit the nail right on the head with that one. I've been looking a lot, studying a lot, the recent events in China and how they've been able to meet the needs of their people. There is no homelessness in China. There are no poor people in China. Everybody got a house in China. Everybody's got a job in China. Even if they have a make-do job, it's a job. Everybody works and everybody contributes. Even the old folks who ain't working sweep the streets and make sure everybody is cool. The aunties take care of people. The government works for the people, not for corporations. It's a big difference in the way people look at themselves and feel about themselves. Here's a country of billions of people who are happy. And we have a country of 300 million people who are about to slit each other's throats. China doesn't have to go to war with us. They can point the way by example. And other countries are starting to realize that as well. They are starting to isolate the United States and isolate the rapacious capitalism of this country. They're saying no more, no more. I can't wait for Chinese cars to come into Canada. I gotta get me one of them. They don't cost much and they're good.
Right, yeah.
Wow. Oh, boy, that's a change.
I love the fact that you pointed out that there's human dignity in work. And again, this is going back to something that I understand from Kurt Vonnegut. From his very first novel, he talked about how dehumanizing it is to have technology that just takes your job away. And it's like, even if the government is subsidizing you and taking care of you monetarily, there's dignity and in just being able to work and contribute to a society. You feel like you're a part of something. And the fact that China is focused on doing that for its people, I think, is important.
Well, you know, I am 81 years old. And when most people are putting their feet up, I'm starting to think that I might be have another role to play. And that is father of a country. I perceive that the Caribbean itself is in grave danger from the fascists in the United States. We are now have the world's largest warships plying our waters. We are shooting people who are out in boats fishing, terrorizing communities, and certain communities in the Caribbean are now class A number one targets for Venezuelan missiles because they are staging points for the U.S. military. All of this is falling on the backs of people who are ill-equipped to deal with this kind of catastrophe. They can deal with a hurricane just fine, but they can't deal with Donald Trump and Nazis very well at all. It's not part of their lexicon.
And it's something that I think is growingly getting worse. I was in the Navy back when Reagan was in power, and I remember some of these things happening back then where we were mining Nicaraguan harbors or we were invading Grenada or whatever. But this just seems to be at another level altogether that makes that look tame.
Indeed. And during the period of time after Reagan invaded Grenada, a lot of sea change, I would say, among Caribbean nations in appreciating the fact that they had better come up with some sort of resistance to the West in terms of their abilities to completely survive. If Reagan can drop, you know, 5,000 troops into Grenada and kill everybody and take over the country, or, you know, what, three helicopters in Venezuela and they snatch them? Oh, boy. You know, that's given an illusion of omnipotence of the United States military, which is just that, an illusion. The military, we have seen the effects of superpowers' militaries on each other in Ukraine. They're both for shit. They don't know what to do. Okay? We have seen the bankruptcy of the military-industrial complex because the machines they make sometimes simply don't work. Or if they do work, they work too well. So what are we going to do is the question once again. I want to take all the countries in the Caribbean and unite them under one banner called the new country, Finlandia, and put up a barrier and say, no, sir, we are going to develop ourselves in a way that we see fit, in a manner that we see fit, and it is not going to include you multinationals. We're going to do it our way. I would really hope that that would happen in my lifetime. I'm working feverishly to make that occur. We are a people who, I consider myself a West Indian man, by the way. We are a people who have survived enormous travails and stresses over the centuries. Almost 95% of us come from slaves or indentured servants of some form or another, even the white folks. So we have a good understanding of how to be at the bottom of the barrel. I think it came as a great surprise to me when I was a guidance counselor in the Virgin Islands and was involved in sending kids to college. I sent 3 Virgin Islanders to Harvard as sophomores, okay? As sophomores. That's how bright our kids are.
So now we've gone through, I think so far I've identified that you were involved in bio and technology and now a guidance counselor, but we haven't even talked about your work in television. Can you give me some background into that? Because that was a pretty significant part of your life, I understand, as well.
Yeah, not necessarily a good one either. The years that I was involved in television from 1968 to 1971. And I worked for 3 different television stations in Boston. I started my career when I was 22 years old. I was on a game show on WGBH, Channel 2 in Boston, which is the educational television channel in Boston. And they liked the way I looked, so they decided to make me a producer. There were no black producers at that time. I was the second black producer in the United States by 4 days, I think. I lasted all of 3 months. I was a music major in college. What did I know about television production? You know, the whole thing was like, oh, this is a great mystery to me. And this was 1968, and there was a lot going on in Boston in 1968. There was busing, and there was also black consciousness. The Panthers were active, and I found myself as the producer of this. I produced a program called Say Brother, which is actually still on Channel 2, and we went into the black community to write the black community story and to put it on television. Well, the black community story in 1968 was pretty violent and radical. We got into a lot of trouble with J. Edgar Hoover and the police.
There were those years. I mean, if you mention the name Hoover, you know you've got those years, right?
Yeah, he tried to shut down Channel 2 over what we were putting on the air. But anyhow, I had to leave because my life was threatened, and I found another job working as a film editor for a television station. I was working in the newsroom. And that was a lot of fun. It was 1968, 1969, 1970. The whole world exploded during those years.
And that's a fact.
I got to witness it up close, and it was really interesting. But I found that the media was creating many of the stories themselves for the great god of sensationalism. And that was something that I could not counter. So I left my experience both in film television and went back to community organizing.
That's interesting that you mentioned that the media itself was so, I'm kind of interpreting this, over sensationalizing the news that it actually became problematic. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, we were the first black news photographers and editors, okay? So if we went out on news stories and unpacked the van and started setting up the equipment, and if it was in the black community, a group of kids would come by. And the kids would all be wanting to get in front of the television show, and, you know, jouncing around. And the next thing you know, because it was 1968, 1969, a riot would break out. And there would be bloodshed. And why did that riot break out? Because we were there. Not because we were photographing the riot, but because we created.
Wow. That's an interesting perspective, but not off track.
Nope. And I couldn't deal with that. I couldn't deal with the corruption also that I was seeing, the collusion between the news agencies and the police departments and the government agencies. It all came to a head one day when this young kid from Canada came down. He had suspenders and a red tie and a white shirt, and he looked real cool. His name was Peter Jennings. And Peter and I and another cameraman went down and covered Chappaquiddick. and the Ted Kennedy fiasco on Martha's Vineyard. That was Peter's first professional outside of his Canadian reporting that he did. He did it for ABC at the time. And it was a real gas to sit out there with Peter and have good fun with him. But also to deal with the police and the Kennedy family. The power of the Kennedy family was astonishing. This is the state of Massachusetts. And in the state of Massachusetts, you don't go up against the Kennedys. So that was a very interesting experience. I know Peter learned a lot from that. All the news people that were involved in the 60s and the 70s had a lot of integrity. And I was very proud and honored to work with many of them. It was the station owners that we had to watch out for.
And I would agree that that's probably the situation we find ourselves in now. I know watching the news about what's happening with CBS is pretty depressing, that this storied news organization historically seems to be suffering from a lot of questions about their current integrity and their ability to actually report news.
Well, I've got some questions. What's going on with the FCC? What's going on with the broadcast legal people who have essentially abrogated their responsibility? When Reagan turned over the fairness doctrine, that was about half of the battle. And the other half of the battle is the ability for community groups to gain control of the licenses that these stations own. These licenses belong to the people. They don't belong to the stations. They pay for them. And if they do not adhere to community standards or our belief system, we can get rid of them. And in Boston, we got rid of two TV stations, WNAC-TV and whatever the other station was that was owned by the newspapers. Both of those stations had to turn over ownership to other people because community groups petitioned the FCC and legally got their license taken away from them. With the advent of cable television, our impact is a lot less on these folks than it was with rather regular TV.
Right.
But at the same time, we're now seeing regular TV going right down the tubes. CBS, Fox, even MSNBC. Even MSNBC is so laxed.
And I think we talked about this the other day when you and I were chatting, and I went through that period. I used to listen every morning. I would catch a podcast version of what was on MSNBC the night before to kind of stay informed about the world. But I'll tell you, after this last election, I couldn't do it anymore. There's nothing there that is any different than probably what people are getting from Fox, kind of on the other side.
I was appalled by Joy Reid and Capehart and their absolute just being as nasty as they could to progressives and to Bernie Sanders during the last election. As black people, they just embarrassed the crap out of me. I couldn't believe that they had done that. Black folks' political power is phenomenal in the Democratic Party. Without us, they ain't got nothing.
And I agree. And I think you mentioned that alienation from a lot of populations. I mean, the youth are also alienated.
Exactly.
And saying there's not any party doing anything for us. I remember having discussions with young people before this last election that said, I'm not going to vote at all because it's pointless. And they probably are right.
You know, that was the way I thought in the 60s. I was a black revolutionary. I believed the system was rigged. And why would I ever vote? I'm not going to vote. That's for fools. That's for suckers. And then I moved to the Virgin Islands, and I was at an airport waiting room with a bunch of my fellow employees from St. Croix. And they said, Magby, you on your way back to vote today, are you? And I said, vote? I never vote. That's for suckers, man. I'm a black revolutionary. I don't vote. And they turned around to me, and they looked me dead in the eye with a great disgust on their face. And they said, Magby, do you know how long it took us to get the vote? I never missed a vote from that day on.
That's a great example.
That's the kick. It's all we got. We got the bullet. We got the vote. That's it.
Yeah, and admittedly, and I know your background with the Friends, certainly, I personally, violence is not going to work for me. I know it's not going to work for me. I have historically said that the day that I have to have a gun to protect myself, I'm just as happy to be gone. I don't need to feel an essential drive to have violence protect me.
No, no. It's an awful thing. If you've ever lived with violence, I live with violence in the Virgin Islands. I lost 42 friends to murder.
Oh, my God.
Okay? 42 people. Small island, get to know everybody. 42 people to murder or a violent death of some sort or another. Over a period of 5 or 6 years, it wears on you. It changes you. It makes you a very different person when you live with that level of violence. People are still paying for that in the Virgin Islands.
And I know there are studies that discuss the trauma of encountering that kind of violence. And I think if you look at any person who served in war, Kurt Vonnegut, again, being a prime example, he was in World War II.
He was in Dresden.
Yeah, and when he came back from that, he absolutely was traumatized.
And who wouldn't be?
Exactly. So you're right. That level of violence in any life is life-changing and not in a good way.
No, it really isn't. And as Kurt says, and so it goes. I loved Kurt. I just loved him. You know, I spent most of my youth on Cape Cod, and he lived in Wellfleet. He was quintessential Cape Cod. He was everything I think about. When I think of the Cape, I think of Kurt.
So did you get a chance to go by the house, or were you aware of the house being there? Or?
No. In fact, I probably swam very close to his house, but never knew he was there.
I know there's so many of those situations that you're in that you don't even realize how close you are to someone of that stature. And then you find out later on, right? But yeah, that's interesting that you had that time out on the Cape too.
Yeah. Actually, Kurt was there when bad things happened on the Cape. We had a serial killer who left a body on his beach. It's pretty awful. It's pretty awful. But anyhow, so it goes. Yeah. So it goes, you know?
Yes, that is life.
Only thing I, you know, we're getting sort of close to the end of this discussion. What I'd like to leave you with, because you keep on asking me, what should we do? Where should we give our money? Where should we give our support? To whom and to how? And Marx and Hegel talked about the dialectic. Synthesis, antithesis. No, I'm sorry. Thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. One thing being true, the opposite being true, and something new coming from it. I think we're not going to be able to go backwards anymore. We're not going to be able to return to the days of Obama and Michelle and have a party on the roof and do all those happy times because too much water over the dam. And we have Nazis at loose in the country who will be at loose when Trump is long gone. They will be here as they have been here forever.
Yes.
So something new has to come out of this. Something new, which I have no clue about what that looks like or where it comes from. And whether it comes from fire, water, or ice, or stone, I do not know. But it is coming. And I don't think there's any way you can put the genie back in the bottle and make it not come anymore. Too much has happened. The whole world is repulsed by us. All of our allies are repulsed by us. They're getting ready to take away our credit card. And when they do that, we are done.
Well, and I found it intriguing when you mentioned uniting the Virgin Islands as its own economic power to protect themselves.
Not just the Virgin Islands, all of the Caribbean.
Okay.
The Virgin Islands alone can't do it by themselves. Right, right. Okay.
I see that same optimism and positivity with Europe. If Europe were to align themselves, leaving the United States aside and do their own thing, you know, make NATO without the United States, they might very well be able to turn the tide on the United States becoming too big for its britches, I think is a way of looking at it.
Well, Max, I'd hate to give you a bad time again, but you know, Canada's getting ready to buy some planes. They have an aging fleet of F-16s that they need to replace. And Trump wants to sell them our planes. They don't want to buy anything from us. They want to buy the Swedish planes or somebody else's planes, maybe the French planes or someone else's planes. I don't want to buy our planes. And we have said that we will send our jets and intrude on their airspace if they don't buy our planes. Alberta is making a break, perhaps to become the 51st state. I'm not sure Canada's going to allow that to happen. The chance of war breaking out on the northern border is not trivial.
Well, and I think that the chance of war breaking out in many places is not as remote as we would like it to be. And the nonsense with Greenland is prime among that.
Yeah. Yeah. And we got Mexico on the back burner as well. And Cuba. Let's not forget Cuba. He's got his designs on that. In fact, he said he's got the designs on the whole Caribbean. Wow. This cannot stand.
And I'm optimistic, hopefully optimistic, that you're right. Something is going to have to change. We are not going to be able to go back to the glory days of the Obama administration and all that. But if it changes and makes the world itself better, I'm going to be far happier anyway, because the border of the United States alone does not thrill me. I am not a patriot in terms of this is the greatest place in the world. A patriot in terms of this is the greatest world that we can live in, and we need to get along as a planet, not just as a country.
We have had our good days.
Yes.
We have had our good days, and those days have been exceptional, okay? And they have shown us a path. If we choose to disregard that path, it's on us. It's on us, okay? And much of my depression has to do with being depressed about my own inability to make this happen, to make this better. I feel just as frustrated as everyone else does in the fact that all of this is happening. And I feel for people and I have great compassion for everyone who's involved in this mess. But at the same time, we really don't have time to grieve. We really don't have time to feel sorry for ourselves. We really don't have time to worry about whether we have enough caviar in the icebox. It's time for another worry, folks. I see folks concerned about all kinds of things, music, art, all these different things. In the context of fascism, none of that is important. You've got one job to do. Do it.
And I appreciate the fact that you brought up that this does tend to lead to some depression. It certainly leads to depression on my part, too, because you do feel so helpless. But a part of what I was trying to promote in this podcast and on the website with this idea of volunteerism and self-care is if you can focus at that micro level in your community and make your community as good as it can be and gain your worth from volunteerism, because that's important work too, at least that can stem the tide of horrible depression. You've got positive things in your life that you can make your world better because you can't control the big macro. It's impossible.
But there's so much that you can control. As I said, living in the Virgin Islands, I lost 42 friends to murder. And the last one was my next door neighbor. And I got really depressed about that and really furious about that. So a group of us organized ourselves and went walking in the community and engaged the young people and just sat and talked to them. And we told them we were real interested in making sure our communities were safe, and that they were safe. And what could we do together to make that happen? They walked with us. You can make a change by simply talking to your neighbors. That's the one thing we don't seem to want to do anymore. We got us some internet and some cable TV, and we don't have to leave our house as long as we have enough weed and beer. We're cool, brother.
Yeah, but it's pretty isolating, and I agree with you. If you can embrace your community and get out into your community and learn who your community are, certainly the most progressive areas of the country that I know of are the ones where there are a diverse and lovely community, and you get to know everybody, and you do realize we're all human beings.
That's right. Look at the state of Massachusetts. It is the 28th economy in the world, largest economy in the world. totally integrated community, despite the will of the Catholic Church and the many people who stood against integration in the state of Massachusetts. But now Massachusetts is integrated like you would not believe. Most of the heads and CEOs are foreigners, immigrants, who will take their companies out of this stupid country if you harass them any further. No more biotech, no more high tech. Is that what you want? I don't think so. Okay, I think you really want to do better than this. And Canada is reaping the whirlwind. So aren't some Caribbean countries offering citizenship for X amount of dollars. They're getting CEOs and people like that. And they say, hey, this is a nice place. We'll move our people down here and out of America. Yesterday, Volkswagen said they're not going to build another plant in Indiana, I believe, because of tariffs. Hyundai, the crazy lady down in Georgia, they ain't building that plant. People are pulling out of the United States. We don't have those jobs anymore. You said you wanted to bring back manufacturing. Well, hey, yo.
It's not working without the immigrants, yeah.
It's leaving. Immigrants make this country work. Minorities make the Democratic Party work. Democracy makes this country work. Why is it broken?
Well, Hugh, you're right. We are at the end of our time now. I want to thank you so much for joining me. And I know that I mentioned the other day when we were on the phone that sometimes these interviews make me a little bit depressed because there's such bad news coming from these interviews, right? But I also have to say you have given me a lot of optimism and hope. And I think that that is what we need in the world is embrace each other, work in your communities to do better, and I think it'll all work out.
Thank you so much for having me on the program. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun, and I wish you the best.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Remember, you can listen to our uplifting interviews from secular saints on your favorite podcast service or at sacredlegions.org. While you're at the website, we hope you'll draw inspiration to practice secular sainthood yourself by exploring our resources page of volunteer and self-care organizations endorsed by our featured secular saints. You can also join our official Patreon page for free by clicking the link at the top of our homepage. There, you'll find bonus content and special notices specially made for the Sacred Legions family. If you have views about the podcast, we would love to hear from you by using our Send Us a Message form at the bottom of our website. Finally, Sacred Legions wants to remain ad-free, but what we do isn't free. So if you love our inspirational guests and the promotion of volunteerism and self-care, how about buying us a cup of coffee by clicking the merchandise link at the top of the website, then selecting the support link or official merch options available there. And thank you, because your kind contribution will help to keep this program going long into the future.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler. Original music by Jamie Callan. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.